Good morning. My name is Katie Frederick, and I wear a lot of hats, but today I am a member of the ACB Ohio Board of Directors, and it is my pleasure to introduce the speaker for this morning's workshop, who gave an awesome keynote address last night. Peter Berg comes to us from the University of Illinois at Chicago Great Lakes ADA Center, where he directs projects and provides technical assistance related to the ADA. And this morning we are going to have a workshop around transportation and also have some discussion. So welcome everyone, and I will now turn the microphone over to Peter.
Thank you very much, Katie. Good morning, everyone. For full disclosure, for those of you that cannot see me, I have coffee that I've spilled all over the left side of my shirt and sleeve. I have about 30 minutes left for my presentation last night, so I'll wrap that up first before we get into transportation. Hope everyone's all right with that. Lunch will be served later. All right, so I want this to be a more of an interactive session, so looking to get input and find out, you know, what questions you have. I do not will not promise that I have all the answers, but I will attempt to do my best. And we'll just start off with talking about a couple of different topics, and first talk about the Air Carrier Access Act. And I'm sure many of you are aware of the Department of Transportation's rulemaking on the issue of service, emotional support, and psychiatric animals, and air travel, and lots of media attention of recent about people trying to board planes with various types of animals. Under the current language of the Air Carrier Access Act, again, you know, the Air Carrier Access Act, not the ADA, applies to actual air travel. Individuals can travel in the cabin. Individuals, passengers with disabilities, can travel with their service animals, as well as psychiatric and emotional support animals. Airlines do have discretion when it comes to individuals that are traveling with psychiatric or emotional support animals. They can require very detailed and specific documentation that must come from a licensed psychiatrist with a specific diagnosis, and indicate, you know, why the individual needs to travel with the psychiatric service animal or the emotional support animal, or why the individual needs the animal when they get to their particular location. Airlines, under the current language of the Air Carrier Access Act, should not be asking, you know, individuals with an obvious need for a service animal, i.e. persons that use guide dogs, blind, or who have low vision. We saw airlines over the summer. Delta was the first to issue new guidance requiring certain types of documentation. There was a lot of pushback from ACB and other disability organizations around this requirement for new documentation, which would include requirements to show proof of vaccination. The National Council on Disability, the federal agency NCD, which provides guidance to the administration as well as Congress on matters impacting persons with disabilities, you know, sent a letter to the Department of Transportation, you know, around these issues and the department's rulemaking on the issue of service animals, you know, stating specifically that the current language of the ACAA does not support or allow airlines to ask for this type of documentation, and pointed out, you know, the obvious negative impacts on persons who travel with service animals and need to travel for work or for emergency or for health situations, because the language, you know, would require 48 hours notice before someone could travel with a service animal and provide that documentation, which obviously would limit someone's ability to travel at the last minute, like other individuals are able to do. So the Department of Transportation just finished some rulemaking. The public comment period closed on that public comment. So we'll see what happens with DOT in terms of how it defines. I think that this rulemaking was more specifically targeted towards those other types of animals that people are allowed to bring onto airplanes. We've had incidents over the years. Earlier this year, we had the individual that tried to board a United flight in New York with a peacock or some type of large bird. I remember when I first started at the ADA Center, reading a news story about a potbelly pig that got loose on a Southwest flight and was charging up and down the aisle. So I think that's what this rulemaking is really geared at, and I think that we're probably looking at some limitations on the types of animals that can be used, and perhaps additional language regarding documentation that airlines can require. For individuals that use guide dogs and service animals, you're going to applaud this, and this is a good thing. One of the things that the airlines have cited have been the increased number of people coming on to airplanes with emotional support, psychiatric service animals, and incidents of animals being aggressive towards airline staff and towards other passengers, and trying to curb that. Obviously, individuals that use guide dogs, this is not just an issue on airlines and airports, but it's an issue in businesses and out in the public. People who are falsely identifying their yes.
I wish I could have taken my snake, because it could have been a rattler.
That thank you very much. All right. I hope you submitted a public comment.
I did.
All right. I want this to be interactive. Just a couple more things on air carrier access, and I'm going to be brief. Yeah, right. The Department of Transportation also, as part of this rulemaking, had proposed suspending enforcement of complaints it received regarding service animals. And NCD, sent a letter to the Department of Transportation, informing or educating the Department of Transportation that they don't have the authority to fail to investigate any complaints under the Air Carrier Access Act. The way that the legislation and regulations are written, that where there is, credible, proof that a violation took place, the Department of Transportation has an obligation to investigate it. Additionally, filing a complaint with the federal agency is the only recourse that individuals have under the Air Carrier Access Act. There is no right of private action under the ACAA. Individuals cannot file a lawsuit. So your only option is to file a complaint with the federal agency. And if the federal agency is saying, we're going to suspend, investigating complaints when it comes to service or emotional support animals, that becomes problematic for people with disabilities, whether it's, whether it's a ESA or it's a psychiatric a service animal. So we'll see what comes of this. But I do expect, that we will see some changes in the Air Carrier Access Act. I think the last changes we're back in 2009 was the last time that the Air Carrier Access Act was updated and provided additional guidance with regards to service, emotional support animals, and so forth. And then just really quickly, that folks understand, it is the airlines that are responsible under the Air Carrier Access Act to provide assistance to persons with disabilities, whether that's getting from the check-in counter to the gate, whether it's getting from the curb to the check-in counter to the gate to the check-in to the kiosk, whether it's getting from gate to gate when someone is transferring, it's the airline that has that responsibility. It is not the airport. Yes, what they do is probably, in my experience, in about 100% of the time, is that they contract. There are companies that provide that service on behalf of the airline. And, I'm sure everyone in the room that has traveled by air has had some bad experiences with these agencies, whether it's poor assistance, poor attitude, whatever the case may be. It is ultimately the airline is responsible. They are contracting with these agencies. They cannot contract away their obligations under the Air Carrier Access Act. Don't accept an explanation of, that's our contractor. There's nothing we can do. It's the airline has the responsibility.
Other questions? Comment. Question also.
All right. Mary Lynn, you can go first.
Okay. Yes, Peter, you say it's airline responsibility. When a complaint is filed against an airline for refusing to give any reasonable accommodation, how long should a person wait to expect a reply, in other words?
You're talking about if filing a complaint with the airline or under the Air Carrier Access Act?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, in the current time frame, I don't know that how quickly they will respond and what's reasonable. It's
okay. I just wondered. This is from March.
Yeah. Yeah, it certainly, follow up. There is, DOT, there is an air traveler hotline for travelers with disabilities that people can call, and there's nothing wrong with following up. Also remember, these federal agencies, are required to respond and to your representatives. You have a representative in the House. You have two U.S. senators. That may not always be the best venue in an election year. I know we're getting close to that. They may be more responsive. But if you're not getting responses from the federal agency, if you file the complaint, whether it's the Justice Department, it's the EEOC, or it's the Department of Transportation, reach out to your representatives and talk to a staff person and say, I filed this complaint back, and then they're not responding to me. They're not even telling me whether it's a valid complaint or whether they're going to, to investigate it.
I just wondered what was a reasonable amount of time to wait.
3 months. I would, if I hadn't heard anything back, I would definitely be following up and asking what's going on.
Okay. And then, Neeral, you have a comment or question?
Yeah.
And make sure you repeat.
Oh, sorry about that.
You did, but just...
Yes.
So
yeah, it's the recorder's right up here.
Okay. Am I the only one that's been, or if you guys any comments, where I request for assistance, and then they come with a wheelchair, and I'm like, no, I can walk, I didn't need an escort.
Sometimes, depending on how big the airport is, you might as well just take the wheelchair and let them wheel you, because I didn't do that, boy, I wish I had.
Yeah. So the comment was, whether people have had experience where they've requested sighted assistance, guided assistance, and they show up with a wheelchair. That's probably not an uncommon experience. I've had it happen to me. I've had the people providing assistance sometimes be angry because I won't sit in the wheelchair. I think that was Sean that made the comment that, he had wished it based on the distance. If that's what you want and it's your right to request that, then go ahead and use it. If you
an idiot and chose not to use it.
Right.
Like,
right.
We'll
have discussion later about whether or not you're an idiot or not. We don't want to be calling names. We don't want to classify. I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. So, but to your point, if that's what you want, then certainly request it. You have the right. And Neeral, if that's something that you don't want, and I want sighted assistance. All I need is an elbow attached to two legs.
Yeah.
So, if you don't want to use a wheelchair, then simply say, And I've had times where the person still pushed the wheelchair, and they wanted to load my luggage in there or whatever. But that's fine if you don't want to. And sometimes, the communication, it's not always the person that comes to assist you. It's not their fault. It's the communication that's coming from elsewhere. And remember that airlines provide you with the ability when you book your travel, whether you're doing it online or you're doing it, over the phone, you have the ability to let them know in advance. And what I do personally is, when I check in, if I'm doing a round trip flight, when I get to the airport and I get my assistance, I always ask them, do they know, at the location where I'm arriving that, I need sighted assistance to get out to ground transportation once I arrive. So. Okay.
The way it used to be. And so now Southwest is the only airline I've ever flown with, so I don't know how the other ones handle it.
Right.
But if you're booking a trip, that's the way you should do it, is book it first, then log in. You can also even add, at least with Southwest, you can even add the trip to your calendar. So if you can do those at the same time. You can tell them you need help, and you can put it on your calendar and keep yourself
So, Sean, what I do is when I book my trip, I have a profile saved with Southwest. And so if I book it online, not through their app, but if I book it on the website, you can, there is a disability assistance option button, and you can click that. And it, I know, I wish they would. But, yeah, I haven't seen anything in the app, and their app has some other issues. But, So if you book online through the website, you are able to choose that option to add disability assistance to your profile, and then you can select. There are check boxes that are well labeled, and you can select what you need from there. Yes, Anne?
My question is, once you board the plane, they give you the safety review, and they say for more details, look at the packet in the seat. Has anybody ever asked all the airlines to have that on
Yeah, I mean, the question is about the safety briefing that that's provided. Yes, they're required to provide that in Braille or an accessible format, or give it to you verbally if that's what you require them to do that. So they do have an obligation to make that information available to you. And if you're not familiar, then certainly you want to ask that. I always make sure to I usually sit towards the front of the plane, but I always want to make sure in case I have in case my boss has booked me in way back in the plane. I want to know what the nearest exits are, so I know in case of an emergency. For those of you that travel with your white cane, you have the right to keep that cane, with you unless it's, some type of safety issue. But really, you have the right to keep that cane with you because expecting the flight attendant to come back with your cane during an emergency is probably going to – you may be waiting a while. So, but to your specific question, yes, you have the right to get that information, in a format that is accessible to you. I'm sorry?
That is made accessible about half the time.
Right. Well, yeah, and a lot of times they, I've had, them proactively offer, Braille to me, but remember, folks, we all, have a voice and, the ability to speak up, and, we may not always want to do that, or there may be an expectation that people are going to know, what our needs are. I've recently done a couple of presentations here in Indiana on, for healthcare providers, and telling that the best thing that you can do in terms of customer service is, how can I assist you, and if the airlines or whomever is not asking you that, we all have a responsibility to make known, what our specific communication needs are, because they're going to be different, and we shouldn't expect that they're going to understand or, even ask us. So it's important that we speak up and make, known what our communication needs. Yes, they should be asking it, but they don't always do that. There are lots of things going on as they prepare for, flights and so forth. So sometimes that may get lost in the shuffle. So there's nothing wrong with speaking up. Verbally, yeah. The current regulations don't support that requirement. Perhaps that's something moving forward that an organization, disability organization, blindness organization may, look at doing, but that doesn't currently exist in the regulations or the legislation to support that. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and yeah, so we can broaden this out. So questions about, you know, documentation and people falsifying. And I'll talk to this in a larger perspective, not just with regards to the Air Carrier Access Act. I would not anticipate anytime soon, so please don't hold your breath, that the federal government getting into the business of registering or certifying service animals, whether under the Fair Housing Act, the Air Carrier. I don't see the federal government getting into penalizing people or making it a federal crime to falsify documentation or claiming that a pet is a service animal. You talked about the online websites. They are readily available. I wish I had thought of those that myself. You know, I wouldn't be speaking here right now. I'd be retired somewhere because those are not regulated. They are not recognized by any federal agency. You know, anyone that has $300 can go register their pet rock and claim it to be a service, assistance, and emotional support animal. It doesn't give it legitimacy. I talked to lots of housing providers who are, you know, quite vexed at, you know, the increase in people, you know, that are requiring the use of emotional support animals. And please recognize when I talk about this that there is a large number of people that benefit from the use of emotional support animals. So, you know, my comments are no way, you know, degrading or any way along that. People do require the use of emotional support animals. They are obviously far different than service animal. Documentation is a huge issue. Documentation is one of the biggest questions that we get around service animals, which is a high topic of calls and emails and questions that we receive to the ADA Center. You know, why can't we require documentation and so forth? Again, the Department of Justice is not going to get in the business of registering, certifying service animals. So you have different laws. Air Carrier Access Act, as I mentioned, airlines can require very specific documentation. That's the one law that allows a covered entity to require very specific, detailed language. The Federal Fair Housing Act, again, when the need for a service or assistance animal is not obvious, housing providers under the Federal Fair Housing Act can require some limited documentation from the resident. So that would be documentation that, one, indicates that the resident has a disability as defined under the Fair Housing Act. Fair Housing Act uses the same definition that's found in the Rehabilitation Act and the ADA. And secondly, that there is a disability-related need for the service or emotional support animal. Fair Housing Act does not talk about an animal being individually trained. When I talk to housing providers and they say, well, you know, this person gave me this documentation that they printed off, you know, off the internet. And I will say that, you know, I would say if I were a housing provider, I'm not saying that this is what you should do, I would not necessarily accept that documentation because, you know, I would require something from a, you know, a healthcare provider indicating that the resident has a disability. And then, I'll let you go in just a second here. And then obviously under the ADA, we're talking about service animals. We're talking about individually trained dogs that perform a particular task or work for someone with a disability. Businesses, state, local governments cannot require any type of documentation, proof of training, certification. When it gets into that public realm, we're really talking about one of the requirements under the ADA that the animal be under the control of the handler. And that means no barking, aggressive behavior. It needs to be with the person at all times. It needs to be on a leash, harness, tether, or where that is, where that would interfere with the work of the dog. It needs to be under the control, you know, through voice commands or you know, hand gestures. The issue of fake service animals. There are, I think it's over 25, it's over 20 states have passed some type of legislation addressing, you know, this issue. In theory, that's great, and hopefully that will, you know, work towards reducing some of the issue of fake service animals. It is a huge disservice to people with disabilities that need their service dogs, whether it's a guide dog or a psychiatric service animal, a work animal, for those individuals with disabilities that need their service dog in order to be able to independently, you know, interact and go around in their community. Fake service animals provide a big disservice for many reasons. One, it puts a large, you know, suspicion on the minds of business owners and operators, small businesses. And, you know, secondly, we have, you know, lots of incidents, and I've heard from, you know, a lot of guide dog users in the states that we serve, you know, incidents of, you know, these so-called service animals being aggressive and going after, you know, after their animal. That gets to the issue of, you know, being under control. You know, I tell businesses, if the animal's barking, it's aggressive, even if it's a service animal, it's not well-trained, and you can require that the animal, you know, be removed. You don't have to allow it. In some instances, businesses have become wary of excluding, you know, a service animal. And, you know, in those instances, I will tell a business or how, you know, if the animal's behaving and it's well-trained, it's not doing anything, and unless you're 100% sure, you know, let it stay. You know, if you're 100% sure it's not a service animal and the person's lying to you or faking, then tell them they can't come in, that you don't allow pets, or that, you know, you can't be in there with your service animal. What has happened on the state level where we've had this type of legislation, you know, making it a felony or misdemeanor, as I said, you know, that's great in theory, but how do you really enforce that? And I think that becomes problematic from a practical standpoint. Michigan, one of the six states that we cover, they have a voluntary registry at the state level where, you know, they require very specific documentation that is allowed. Because it is a specific program, you don't have to register it as a voluntary registry. But if you do that with the state, it's through the Michigan Department of Civil Rights, you are issued documentation that you can carry with you and show to businesses that you have registered your animal with the state. That is great, you know, when it's on a voluntary basis. The Michigan Department of Civil Rights, and I've had, you know, multiple discussions with some of their staff on this, is, you know, they have to work at educating businesses, you know, because you don't want businesses flipping this around and telling people that use service animals, people with disabilities, saying, well, no, you have to have documentation from the state, and because that obviously is in violation of the ADA. But those type of voluntary registries can be beneficial. They can be beneficial. I know we're off the topic of transportation, but we get into the service animal discussion. But those voluntary let me shut up.
No.
Sorry. All right. Yes, I will get to your questions. I see your hands. Those voluntary registries can be beneficial in educational, you know, settings as well. You know, colleges and universities can be beneficial. So, questions. Hands are raised. So, who's first? Who's?
Housing businesses would have access to just check the database. You wouldn't have to carry documentation around. If you weren't on the database,
sure,
they wouldn't arrest you for anything, but they would just say, no, you don't have a service dog, you're not here.
Yeah, so good comment about having it some sort of national database like E-Verify or something, a database of service. Remember under the ADA that a service animal is defined as an individually trained dog, and there are instances where individuals train their own service animals. You know, dogs are smart, and individuals, you know, the dogs can pick up on, you know, what the needs of the person are. And, you know, someone that has difficulty walking may have a larger dog, and, you know, over time the dog just naturally stands up and, you know, provides assistance, you know, stability while the person's walking, or the dog over time, you know, begins to pick up things or pull someone that uses a wheelchair. So yes, I agree that would be a great solution for individuals. You know, obviously, individuals that have guide dogs, you go through very specific training through guide dog training schools, and that would be an excellent solution. But there still is a, you know, a population of individuals that do train their own service animals where there would be that gap. And then now you're talking about creating some sort of rubric or something. Okay, now you have to take your service animal and it has to pass, you know, these, you know, 5-6 points in order to be declared a service animal. Again, and I'm not, you know, discounting what you're saying. I think it's in the details of how do you work that out at a national level. And as I said, I don't see anytime soon, you know, the federal government getting into regulating this issue. Even over time, you know, perhaps because it is, you know, businesses continue to complain about this. But well, let's go to the next question or comment.
A harness or a vest or whatever that looks legitimate. I I'm wondering if advocacy organizations should go to these retailers and say, hey, y'all really shouldn't allow these items to be sold because they do such a disservice. Like, I wonder if we should, if the actual retailers, Amazon, eBay, whoever, should be approached to say, hey, you realize you're harming people that really need these, and maybe you should consider not selling such items.
Right. Yeah, and certainly that's something that you know ACB and other organizations can look at doing. Yeah. But those same websites that register service and emotional support animals also peddle that same merchandise and the vest and all that stuff. Are there a question or comment? Well, let's move on for a second here. I know I wanted this to be interactive, and we've been interactive. Just a couple other things. Touching briefly, I don't know a lot about the whole self-driving, automated, vehicle, movement that's taking place in there. The governor of the state of Illinois just recently signed some executive order to allow counties and educational institutions to apply to become testing entities, to test these automated vehicles in the state of Illinois. You know, the concept I think has some great potential for people with disabilities in general and specific individuals that are blind or who have low vision. You know, any opportunity, any possibility of increased transportation increases the independence of people that are blind or have low vision. But it has to be, as this moves forward, the voice of the disability community needs to be part of that whole discussion, because we've already had, for instance, in the city of Chicago, the city council, pass an ordinance that any self-driving vehicles have to be an individual with a proper Illinois driver's license has to be in the vehicle behind the wheel when the vehicle is being operated. Well, you make that an initial requirement at the federal level or at the state level, that automatically eliminates the people with disabilities who don't have driver's license who could benefit a great deal from this type of technology. Lots of details in how that would exactly work, going forward, but just something to keep an eye on, and I'm sure ACB, and other disability organizations. I know the National Council on Disability has weighed in several times in letters that it has sent to the Department of Transportation as legislation and regulations are adopted on this issue. A couple other things before just opening up completely to comments. Getting to, to fix route service and paratransit service. We know that under the ADA, transit agencies that operate fixed route service are required to provide what is called a complementary ADA paratransit service. And this is designed for three categories of users, individuals who, because the transit a vehicle or the stop they want to use is not accessible to them. It also, the second category of eligibility are individuals who, because of a disability, are unable to independently navigate the transit system. And this is where you could have individuals who are qualified for certain trips, but not for all trips. So someone traveling to an area where they are not familiar may qualify for a paratransit trip. And then the third category is where there is a disability-specific reason why the individual cannot use the transit agent. The transit public or the fixed route service. So someone, for instance, with multiple sclerosis who during the summertime or during extreme cold periods, can't wait at a bus stop because of the disability. We have seen increased use of fixed route service by persons with disabilities over the the past decade or so. That's a good thing. The ability to use fixed route service is where you don't have to make arrangements in advance to schedule your ride and all the different myriad of issues that come with paratransit. That is great. In PACE, which is the suburban transit provider in Chicago, is responsible for paratransit in the Chicago area. They've had increased efforts over the past few years or a number of years doing different types of travel training get individuals to use fixed route where it's appropriate and where the individual is comfortable and able to use that. I think that is beneficial for the transit agency and, more importantly, for people with disabilities. Again, giving greater mobility to individuals with disabilities. Paratransit rides are much more expensive than a fixed route ride. So where, people who are capable are getting onto the fixed route bus that opens up needed financial resources to, you know, to better serve the individuals that need the paratransit service, that need that door-to-door or curb-to-curb service. I think the federal government, this is just my own commentary here, you know, needs to step up and provide federal funding. You know, paratransit service is primarily funded at the state level. And that's a huge amount of money, and where there has been limited, you know, additional funds coming in general for transportation. You know, the state of Illinois, you know, for a period of time, we went without a state budget for a number of years. There was no investment in transportation. You know, the commuter rail service that I ride almost on a daily basis has been incapable of purchasing, you know, new engines and vehicles, which at times has led to breakdowns. So funding in general is a huge issue. It's not just a disability-specific issue. It impacts lower-income individuals who live in certain parts of urban areas, you know, that rely, you know, solely on public transportation to get to, as I talked about last night, to get to work, to education, to healthcare. It's a big issue. There needs to be more funding in general for transportation. Transportation in rural areas has always been an issue. There just isn't fixed route service in there, and you're dependent on other types of transportation. It's a huge impact on individuals with mobility disabilities, but just in general, any type of public transportation in rural areas is huge. We have the rideshare services, Uber and Lyft, and there was a new one that a driver was telling me about last weekend that he has signed up to do. I think that these services in general have been great. For me personally as a blind person, and perhaps for many of you out there, I love the ability to be able to interact with a driver and assist in, you know, telling them where I am, you know, that the type of assistance I may or may not need. I know in the past trying to rely on cabs, taxis in Chicago area and hoping to get in contact with the cab driver and give them specific information, you know, and let them know where I was located was problematic. Now, Uber and Lyft, you know, is not great for all people with disabilities. Access Living, which is the Center for Independent Living that serves Chicago, filed suit against Uber late last year due to the lack of wheelchair-accessible vehicles. And, you know, that's a big issue for parts of the disability community, lack of accessible vehicles. But also remember, the ADA does not require taxi companies to have wheelchair-accessible vehicles. That is not a requirement under the ADA. The ADA only requires cab companies to have accessible vehicles if they operate new vehicles that are other than a sedan. So if they purchase brand new, never used minivans or SUVs, then they have to begin to incorporate accessible vehicles. Otherwise, they're not required to do so. The reason why there are so many wheelchair accessible vehicles in the city of Chicago is because of city ordinances that require that. That's done at a local level. Same thing in other areas, such as New York. That's a requirement. It's not an ADA requirement. So, you know, why I bring that up is because, you know, while that has been a boon and beneficial to people that are blind or low vision and opening up, you know, other transportation opportunities, especially as you get, you know, further out into suburban areas, there are other issues from other parts of the disability community. And sometimes, you know, when I talk about last night, the number of people with the, you know, disabilities, and it's the largest minority community in the United States, there are lots of different needs across the spectrum of people with disabilities. So our needs and priorities don't always, match up. And trying to advocate, you know, isn't always an easy thing to advocate with one voice. So that's just an area where, you know, you get pushback from one part of the disability community while it's, you know, beneficial. I know that there have been issues with guide dogs and refusal of drivers, and there have been lawsuits and settlements in California, and ACB has been involved in some of that, and you know, hopefully driver training you know, continues to improve, and Uber and Lyft step up to educate their drivers in that particular realm. What else do I want to say? How are we doing on time?
We are good. 15 minutes.
15 minutes. All right, let's do questions, comments, and it's getting cold up here.
Thank you. say that the sidewalk can have a differential of 3/4 of an inch between one sidewalk and another, and yet I believe the ADA says it's 1/2 inch. So this can make travel really hard if you're going, trying to exercise or travel by walking, to have all these bumps in the sidewalk from one section to another. And the city tried to tell me that, oh, they don't have to follow that, but they're responsible. They have legal rights over the tree lawn area, so, and the sidewalk, so.
Yeah, excellent comment, Ann. And that was something I had wanted to talk about, is the public right-of-way and the impact of the inaccessibility or just the lack of sidewalks has on abilities, people's ability to get around and get to transportation stops. And there is a disconnect. I just spoke to someone earlier this week from a public transit agency up in central Wisconsin who was calling and had questions about, you know, their, you know, the sidewalks and sidewalks, you know, not connecting to the public, you know, transportation stops. And I was talking to the person about the responsibility of the municipality that has responsibility for maintenance of those public sidewalks. And then as this discussion got, you know, further along, it turned out that the transit agency was proactively putting in bus stops in areas that were not connected to the public sidewalk. And that's on the transit agency. That's not on the local municipality. But there is a disconnect. You will, if you talk to a municipality or a transit agency, that's their responsibility. It's not my responsibility. You know, ultimately, it's both their responsibilities. The transit agency, if they're putting in new bus stops, altering existing bus stops, there is a requirement in the Department of Transportation, ADA standards, that those bus stops connect to a public sidewalk, that there be an accessible route from the stop to the sidewalk. Public sidewalks and curb cuts and crossings and audible pedestrian signals is another issue. It has a huge impact. GSA, General Services Administration, did a large study about a decade ago about this negative impact, you know, of how the lack of accessibility in the public right of way negatively impacts the people with disabilities' ability to use public transportation or just to get out into the public. The ADA does not require sidewalks. That is not a requirement. There are certain instances where sidewalks do serve as an accessible route from a parking lot to a building entrance, but in general, the ADA doesn't require sidewalks. The U.S. Access Board, which is the federal agency that is designed with creating the design guidelines, I can use the word design one more time, under the ADA, has draft guidelines for the public right-of-way. So that's your sidewalks, your street crossings, street furniture. Those are guidelines at this point. The Federal Highway Administration, which has enforcement under the ADA for public entities in the public right-of-way, has encouraged public works departments and states to use those draft guidelines to incorporate those. And in many instances, states have been doing that. There has been in Ohio increased recently, the state has reached out to local municipalities around this issue of doing self-evaluations and creating transition plans for the public right of way. In Indiana, that happened a few years ago because the Federal Highway Administration reached out about 5 years ago. In Indiana, it's a different animal, and they have a little better control because all federal money, as I understand it, goes through the state. So they mandated that all communities, all public entities, do self-evaluations, do a transition plan, and identify and designate an ADA coordinator. So Indiana was a little ahead of the game in doing that. But it is a huge issue. You know, currently, you know, the Access Board is ready to publish as a final guideline the public rights of way rule, you know, and that is something that is a decade or more than a decade in the works, and ACB and other disability organizations had a lot of input in the drafting of those guidelines. But as you may or may not be aware, under the current administration, in order for a federal agency to publish new regulations or standards, they have to rescind two other rules or two other guidelines. What, you know, what's the Access Board going to do? Are they going to rescind the accessibility standards under the ADA or their accessibility requirements under Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act or Section 255 of the Telecommunications Act? So Unfortunately, we're not going to see any enforceable standards for the public right-of-way at this particular time. On the positive side, I think that you do see more and more public works departments incorporating these draft guidelines into use. And this is where you can you can be a voice within your community. You know, ask your local municipality, you know, what's being done. You know, have you done a self-evaluation of your public right of way? Do you know where curb ramps are missing and detectable warnings and where you have public transportation stops that are not connected, you know, by sidewalks, and be a voice. Join, you know, disability advisory committees in your community. If they don't exist, ask your representatives, your mayor, your city manager, your council people, all their people, you know, why there isn't a disability advisory commission.
Can I ask, bring up 3 points? Quickly,
yes.
Real fast?
Yes.
Okay. I'm doing it quickly. There's a town north of us where virtually every corner has a roundabout. Second, Indianapolis is going to put in the red line, the green line, and the purple line. But the problem with the red line, it's rapid transit, is you have to use only coupons, and you have to buy them at designated kiosks, so they're going to be in weird places. We've got to figure out maybe a way we can use real money on this thing. And third, if you're flying Southwest and you run into these kiosks where they're not accessible, and if you can't use the kiosk, you get to stand in line again at the ticket counter. Any comments on any of these?
To the third one, the Department of Transportation published rules 2 years ago, 3 years ago, that require the accessibility of those kiosks. I think it's 25% are required to be accessible. I think that eventually what you'll see 100% because you'll see vendors saying, you know, why do I make two machines when I can just make one that's accessible? So those should be becoming more prevalent in the airports, the accessible, you know, kiosks. The issue of your second point of being able to use cash and the location of the vending machines, that's more of a usability issue and an advocacy issue. Yes, you can make a case that it's more difficult for people with disabilities to locate them and so forth. I'm not an attorney, so I'm sure someone can make a legal argument why, you know, potentially it's a violation of the ADA, but I think it becomes more of just a, you know, common sense usability issue with regards to that. You know, roundabouts, the Access Board has done studies on roundabouts and, you know, the problems that they pose for people that are blind or low vision and you know, being able to identify where the traffic is coming from when it doesn't stop.
So I think, this is Katie, just to say, I think a lot of these points that we've talked about so far really bring up the need for us, for all of us to advocate at the local level in our communities and, you know, again, to get involved with transportation and ADA issues as a whole, because there are a lot of changes and things occurring in our local communities that we need to be mindful of and advocate for as people with disabilities. So again, if you're not a member of the city's disability advisory committee, or your city doesn't have one, you know, you can, you know, write letters to council members and get involved that way and advocate locally with, you know, with council or with your city management. So it is a worthwhile to try to get involved at the local level and help bring change about to your local community. Are there any other comments or questions? We have about 5 more minutes left. So any other questions or comments?
I have a question.
Okay, Brian.
Sure. It, you know, as I talked about last night, if the ADA were gone, there are still other avenues to pursue, you know, complaints. State of Indiana, state of Ohio, you know, have laws that prohibit discrimination by places of public accommodation, private businesses on the basis of disability. The ADA is the highest level that, you know, a complaint that you can, you know, file or lawsuit. So, you know, seeking other, you know, remedies, first, you know, advocating, reaching out to the business owner. If it's the business owner, sometimes people go to social media or you know, to local media. But there are avenues through the Ohio Civil Rights Commission, through the Indiana Civil Rights Commission, reaching out to, you know, disability-specific organizations. Access for people that are blind or low vision and guide dogs to businesses, to transit is a high priority for ACB. It's a priority. It's a priority. So, reach out to your local chapter affiliate. Become involved, and as Katie was talking about, with those issues. But let people know. I was at Progress Center, which is the Center for Independent Living that serves suburban Cook County, this past Tuesday, and they talked about that they were thinking about forming a committee of people with disabilities that use paratransit around those issues. And, you know, I talked about, you know, that's great, you know, as long as there is specific purpose to that, you know, to that committee. What is the end game? Because remember, you know, it's great to vent and sit around and talk to, you know, other, you know, like-minded individuals or individuals who've had similar, you know, instances, issues with access, whether it's being denied, you know, because of a service dog or being denied effective communication. It's great to share those experiences with other individuals. But if you don't take that next step and do something about it in letting, you know, an enforcement agency or letting an advocacy agency or reaching out to your protection and advocacy service, Equip for Equality in Illinois, you know, will frequently get involved in service dog issues. It's one thing that they look at and you know, reach out to the business and resolve those types of issues. So, Katie talked about becoming involved. Become involved in your, you know, protection and advocacy service, Disability Rights Ohio or Indiana Disability Rights. And if they're not, you know, if that's not one of their priorities, you know, service animals and blindness issues, you know, go to their meetings, participate, you know, submit comments, contact them, and let them know that this is an issue. This is what I'm experiencing, and it's not a one-time issue. You know, and there are other individuals that have had similar circumstances. So when you have that larger voice of, you know, more people stepping up, it's not an isolated incident. That's where hopefully you begin to see, you know, some change. But simply, you know, gathering as a group and complaining and saying, well, if I complain, nothing ever happens. That you know, if that's how you want to move forward, then that, you know, that's your choice. But we really need to be engaged in order for change to take place.
Quickly, and then we do need to wrap up so that we can stay on time. Right. So again, for those of you that use Uber or Lyft in the app under the help section, you can report if you have had an issue with a driver. You can also, at the end of your ride, or you know, if the driver cancels on you, you have the opportunity to rate that driver and provide feedback. And also, contacting the company will often assist in resolving the issue. I do want to wrap this up. It is about 11:15, and we do need to keep on schedule. So I want to, Peter will be around, correct, for the rest of the weekend? So yes, so if people have questions, feel free to ask him if we didn't get to your question today or comment. But let's give Peter a thank you very much for coming.
Now, my girlfriend just applied for Uber, and now they have very stringent requirements. And they tell them you must accept animals, and they realize that, hey, maybe your family doesn't like it, and maybe you actually are allergic to it, mm-hmm. but if you're driving that vehicle, that you have to do that. And someone was telling me, if you have a problem, just give them a 1-star rating and then Uber will contact you. I don't know if they still do that.
There are some legitimate, you know, reasons why a driver may not be able to take a service animal. A lot of times they're not legitimate. If there is a driver who, you know, has an allergy to service animals to where it raises to the level of meeting the definition of disability under the ADA, then obviously, you know, Uber, Lyft, you know, has an obligation to accommodate that driver and not require that they take service animals or that they, you know, be penalized. But I think more often than not, it's individuals, you know, simply claiming because they don't want a dog in their car. Now, there are also reasons, religious reasons. About a decade ago, there was a big issue at the airport up in Minneapolis where drivers, this was taxi cabs, refused to pick up passengers that had service dogs, and it was for religious reasons. And the way that they resolved it at the airport to you know, reconcile both, you know, a religious freedom as well as a disability rights issue was that the taxi cab drivers, if for religious reasons, could deny or not choose to pick up someone with a service animal, but they would have to go to the end of the line, you know, the cab line, and wait for their, you know, the next time. But the issue of you know, allergies, being afraid of animals, is something that comes up frequently in employment settings and educational settings. And, you know, the ADA is clear. It is specifically in the regulations that a person with a disability has the right to be accompanied by their service dog wherever the general public is allowed to go. In an educational setting, and I know you're talking about transportation, but in an educational setting, you know, if there is another student that actually has an allergy or, you know, something, you know, a disability that's impacted by the presence of an animal, the university or college may have another obligation to put that student in another class. But the ADA is clear in all areas, whether it's transportation, education, businesses. The person with a disability has the right to be accompanied by the service.
Okay, that brings up two questions. And first of all, so you're saying then a driver could pre-qualify, so to speak, with Uber, Lyft and say, look, I am so allergic to animals, I just cannot take a dog, period, and I have the right on that. I'm not going to lose my job. And if that is the case, then should people specify when they get the ride that they have a service animal. So if that driver hopefully needs to bow out, that they will do that and is in the right to do so and get a driver there who is going to take them and their animal.
Yeah, I mean, that could be something voluntary, optional, you know, as part of the Uber or Lyft app. You know, you can't require someone to say that I'm traveling with a service animal.
Right, so what would be recommended, yeah, maybe? That
recommended would be, you know, it certainly to have that feature. Again, you know, there would likely be rare instances where someone who, because of a disability, you know, can't take a service animal. And that individual, you know, should be in contact with their Uber or Lyft, and they may need to provide some documentation to document it, that, you know, so they're not penalized for refusing in those rare instances where a driver who has a disability related allergy, you know, cannot take a passenger with a service dog.
Well, let me switch to a topic. I'm not from Indianapolis, but the issue here is the paratransit company Open Door, and they have a very, very high rate of late pickups and arrivals. I think it's maybe in the 70% area. It's very high, some 1 to 2 hours. So I guess maybe my question to you is how people, because I've said people here are going to have to unite to advocate to get some changes. How would they do that?
And they're Open Doors, because this is, you know, I'm somewhat familiar with what's going on. I know there was an article in the Indianapolis Star recently and was picked up by the student newspaper down in Bloomington in Indiana. From a regulatory and enforcement perspective, you know, those type of late arrivals potentially run into, you know, a trip denials. You know, basically, if you pick someone up so late, it's a trip denial because they're not getting to where they need to be. One of the things that transit agencies should be really looking at when they talk to their consumers, their passengers with paratransit, the real focus should be on what time the person needs to be to where they're going, as opposed to necessarily the pickup time. Obviously, you don't want to have to pick up someone 5 hours in advance. That's not allowed. You know, a transit agency can negotiate an hour on either side of what a person's requested pickup time is. But the focus should be, you know, what time does the person need to, what time do they start work? What time do the school start? What time do they need to be to their doctor's appointment? That should be the real focus. In terms of, you know, how to change that and put pressure, there is an advisory committee that you know provides information and advice to the paratransit service and to the transit agency. So advocating, you know, through that agency, there is a Center for Independent Living, Accessibility is the Independent Living Center here in Indianapolis. You know, the Protection Advocacy Service, Indiana Disability Rights. You know, so lots of different you know, levels. And as I, you know, have talked about a couple of different times during the, you know, the convention, is documenting and, you know, getting, you know, multiple instances and being able to show this is not isolated. This is not just one late pickup that caused me to arrive late at work. These are multiple incidents. It's happening across the board. And, you know, here's the documentation. Here's the proof that we have to show that.
Now, some cities are outsourcing, and maybe that's the direction that they need to go. But all these advisory boards at least meet once a year, right? Some kind of public forum where people can actually come to a central location. And
yeah, a lot of them, you know, minimally meet on a quarterly basis. Some of them meet more often than that. But again, it is that voice. And you know, I always tell, you know, public entities, state and local governments, that if you don't have some type of advisory commission, it really makes sense to do so. You know, one, it assists you in ensuring that you're compliant and integrating the service that you're providing and making it fully accessible to people with disabilities. Secondly, it shows a commitment to the disability community that you're really interested in inclusion of people with disabilities and it providing that platform, that voice. Not that your advisory commission necessarily speaks for the entire disability community, but if you have that input along the way, you know, and you're doing things or you make changes, you're less likely to face, you know, large resistance when something changes because you did make that process. And like you mentioned, having those public forums, you know, invite people to come in and comment. Sometimes it may be, you know, critical, but you know, sometimes it's something that the agency needs to hear.
Well, thanks, Peter, for your time. And we're going to have to take a break. We have to move equipment. We're going back and forth between a partition area here, folks. So we will talk to you in just a few moments, folks.